Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
And I'm a full-time soccer coach.
Yeah.
And pretty busy.
Yeah. Full-time dad now.
Full-time dad.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of stuff going on.
Yeah. I'm a full-time grandpa and a dad.
There you go. So. Finally back in the studio to record this episode.
Yeah, yeah, you were a busy man all last week and all this weekend, and
well, I
just sat around and said, "Oh, Michael shows up to record soon."
I was busy lawyering last week too.
I know. Yeah, you had all kinds of things going on.
I had a
soccer season.
Had a mediation.
Mm-hmm.
Had a pretrial.
Yeah.
Got an arbitration. There's a lot going
on. And arbitration and and mediocrity.
Well, no, not mediocrity.
Oh, is that something different?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I don't dabble in that.
We're exceedingly mediocre. Isn't that what that one review said that wasn't a while back?
Oh, maybe. I don't know.
Exceedingly mediocre.
I tend not to pay attention to the negative ones.
I like
Although that may have been a positive one.
I like to read those. It's like mean tweets that Jimmy Kimmel does.
Yeah.
I love to see that they have the stars on there read the mean tweets. That just cracks me up. Some of their responses when they're reading. Sometimes people can't even get through them. They're reading them, and they are so funny that the people read them, even though it's about them, they can't even get through them.
They just start laughing.
Yeah.
Well, today's episode is going to be about vicarious liability, respondeat superior, and agency. And I don't think we've done this topic before, but if we did, we'll consider it your fault.
Okay, because I have the shortest memory.
Well, no, because that's kind of what vicarious liability is.
Oh.
That was kind of a tongue-in-cheek joke.
A tongue-in-cheek one?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I thought it was like people that live vicariously through their kids. You know, like the guy never was much of an athlete, so he pushes his kid to be a soccer star or tennis star or football star or whatever so that he can live the same glory that his kid has or something like that. That's what I thought you meant when you said that vicariously. That's why I've always heard that.
Live vicariously through your children?
Yeah, that's right. I always wanted to be a dancer, and you push your daughter into dance lessons all the time or something?
No, nope. It's not what this is about.
Oh, okay. So we're not going to push kids around.
You always wanted to be a beauty queen, so you push your daughter into being a beauty queen.
Yeah, pageant queen.
Pageant queen.
Like Honey Boo Boo.
Yeah, I guess. Is that still a thing?
Yeah, Toddlers and Tiaras came back on with a whole new round of kids being tortured, and Charlie loves it. That's one of Charlie's secret pleasures.
Really?
Yeah. Toddlers and Tiaras.
Why does she like it? Do you know?
I think she likes to do all the dressing up herself. Mm-hmm. She doesn't like to do it for pageants. She just likes to do it for day-to-day living.
Right.
She often picks princess dresses and crowns to wear for a night out.
Oh, I know. She showed up at my house before wearing a dress and a tiara. Oh,
yeah.
Hello.
Yeah, that's just her standard casual dinner wear. So she identifies with all those girls all made up and everything. She even said, "Pop, do you think I could get a flipper?" I said, "No, you don't need a flipper."
Well, so now this concept of the common law concept is respondeat superior, and it actually has its roots back in ancient Rome.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So back then, the concept was generally applied just to slaves, though, and the meaning was basically translated as servants. So, like, you know, that's what it applied to. And the slave could not pay themselves for an act. So, essentially, whatever they were doing was at the behest of their owner. So, whenever their owner instructed them to do something, their owner was liable for whatever the slave did because they were essentially acting in the shoes of the owner. That kind of makes sense.
But they could never catch them because they were roaming around.
Your jokes are all Greek to me. <Ba-dum-tsh>. Oh, I hate myself. Why did I say that? Can we edit that out?
Yeah, that's all right. You're living vicariously through my jokes.
Yeah, I am. In 1698, the doctrine was actually mentioned in dicta by Lord Holt in the English case of Jones v. Hart. And in the U.S., it was discussed in a case of Wright v. Wilcox in 1838. The Wright v. Wilcox case is where a boy climbed on a wagon driven by the defendant's servant, who drove his horses faster, causing the boy to be thrown and injured. The judge ruled that the master was not responsible under respondeat superior because the servant had acted in a way in driving horses that the master had not assented to, and therefore was not within his scope of employment. So that was kind of one of the little areas where there's a kind of carved out that basically
he didn't say drive recklessly and get there as fast as you can. Huh?
Exactly.
And any kids on there, just let them fly out the back.
That's right. That's their own problem. Another interesting take on this theory was by Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr.
Easy for you to say.
I know. I knew that was going to be coming.
He has too many names.
Basically, in 1891, he said, it is hard to explain why a master is liable to the extent he is for negligent acts of one who, at the time, really is his servant, acting within the general scope of his employment. Probably master and servant are feigned to be all one person by a fiction. So basically, he said that it was kind of a not really common sense. He was against it. He didn't really see why it would be like that. So that's the one point of view from the wealthy people probably saying, like, well, we don't think we should have to pay for this.
Well, then otherwise you could order your servant to go kill somebody that, you know, somebody that was a business rival or something like that.
Yeah. Now, there was a British attorney named Thomas Beatty in 1916, and he basically said that it was basically just a deep pocket theory derived from an inconsiderate use of precedents and a blind reliance on the slightest word of an eminent judge and from the mistaken notion that his flights of imagination were actually decided cases. So, they basically, didn't think too much of it, some of these jurists in the past.
I don't know. I think it's a pretty sound theory that if you're ordering somebody what to do, that you're responsible for the things you order them to do. As long as they're acting on your behalf of what you told them.
I think it seems logical as well. So typically when it comes up, it's an employer-employee relationship. That's when we see it in this day and age, because obviously we don't have slaves anymore. Well, I guess there are slavery places in some places in the world.
Other countries,
but... Mm-hmm. Not anywhere that we're familiar with any kind of jurisprudence or anything like that. So
right. Not where U.S. law reaches.
Exactly. U.S. law does not allow that.
That's right.
So
that's all we're going to say about that.
So traditionally under common law, there is no vicarious liability whenever there is an independent contractor. And generally, the work had to be performed underneath the scope of employment. So again, something that was outside the scope of employment might not have any kind of liability for the employer.
So if you're an independent contractor, you're basically working on your own. Although you've been hired to perform a task, you're not really working under the direct instruction. The guy doesn't tell you do this, then do that. He just says, I want this wall built.
Right.
He doesn't tell you how to build it.
Exactly.
It's just up to you to do it.
And that's under the common law theory, but as applied in today's legal spectrum, typically independent contractors can actually... You can still be vicariously liable for your independent contractor sometimes too. So even that was kind of one of those historic common law type designations that's kind of been done away with to a certain degree.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Sure. As much as any point of the law makes sense.
So really this doctrine can be applied to any kind of agency type relationship. And by agency, I mean where you're employing somebody as an agent of your actions. Again, that would be like an independent contractor or an employee-employer type relationship. Or, you know, possibly if you exercise some domain over someone and you instruct them to go do something, then you could probably be liable for whatever you instruct them to go do as well.
Like a teacher directing a pupil? You exercise domain. The teachers exercise domain over the children.
Yeah, I mean, you could maybe kind of stretch some sort of legal theory there. If you're a teacher and you tell a child to go out and... like maybe they're on safety patrol and you tell them to go and stick their safety patrol flag into a car and if they run through that thing, just, you know, bash their car with that, whatever, then, you know, maybe the teacher might be liable for that. I don't know.
Or if they say, it's lightning outside, go out there and climb up on top of the jungle gym and stick your hand up in the air and act as a lightning rod to protect the rest of us.
Well, I mean, I think that would be just direct liability against the teacher themselves, not necessarily, because the whole theory of vicarious liability is that one party is responsible for making another party do something, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But the party who's doing the act is not the one who suffers the injury. It's usually somebody else.
Yeah.
So you got to have one more layer in there.
I saw a guy on a video this morning get struck by lightning.
Really?
Yeah. They had he was caught on some kind of a surveillance camera, and he's walking his dogs, and he's walking along. I'll say you just see like big sparks fly up from under his feet, and he just goes down like a ton of bricks.
Really?
And a couple of people, there was one guy sitting in a car, and there was a couple others saw it happen, and they went running over to him and administered CPR and brought him back around, but his heart had stopped.
Was the dog okay?
Yeah, the dogs were fine.
Okay, that's the important part.
That's right. Otherwise, they'd have been hot dogs.
You know, I just had a thought.
Your first one?
The AC/DC song, AC/DC song, Thunderstruck.
Yeah.
Shouldn't it be Lightning Struck?
Well, that doesn't sound as good.
You're right. Those are like one of those shower thoughts.
Yeah, it's Lightning Struck. No, that doesn't sound good. Thunderstruck sounds good.
It does sound good.
Especially when you're the thundering herd, although they're not doing much thundering these days.
No, they're doing a bunch of... I can't even say plundering, because that doesn't rhyme.
Instead of the thundering herd, they're more like the blundering turds.
I will agree with that. So there are three considerations generally when you're looking at to determine whether or not there's this kind of relationship. Was the act committed within the time and space or the limits of the agency? Was the offense incidental to or the same general nature of the responsibilities of the agent that was they were to perform? Was the agent motivated to any degree to benefit the principal by committing the act? So when you look at all those different kind of things, you can apply a general consideration about whether or not this kind of theory might apply. So now you can almost use these terms interchangeably, the respondeat superior with vicarious liability, but vicarious liability is kind of more of a term that is used in the modern era. It's not something that has its roots back dating back to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
But it's based on that same kind of theory. And as used in this day and age, vicarious liability is strict secondary liability that arises under the common law doctrine of agency or respondeat superior, the responsibility of the superior for the acts of the subordinate, or in a broader sense, the responsibility of any third party that had the right, ability, or duty to control the activities of a violator. So it's distinguishable from contributory liability, which is another form of secondary liability. And unlike contributory infringement, knowledge is not an element of vicarious liability. So there doesn't have to be any knowledge or anything like that. It's just basically strict liability. And the way the law has developed is that some relationships by their very nature require the person who engages others to accept responsibility for the wrongdoing of those others. And it makes sense to me that if you are an employer and you have your employee do something that is negligent and there's some sort of accident because of it, then you should be on the hook for it.
This is true. And even if you are on the hook for it, what I'm thinking of is like when I work for the railroad, you're on the hook for it, even if they're doing something you didn't tell them to do. Like say they break a safety law or an operating rule or something like that, and they run their train into your car or something like that. You know, they didn't blow the horn. It's a federal regulation that you have to blow the horn in a certain pattern when you go across a crossing.
Yeah.
If you don't blow the horn, that pretty much makes you liable for it.
It could, but I mean, if you have standard safety protocols and you instruct them on them regularly and you do that and they just choose not to follow it, I mean, you could also make an argument that, hey, where were we negligent in this? We've done everything necessary to train this person to do it. It's just by their own stupidity they didn't do it.
Well, I guarantee you, though, the railroad ends up paying for it.
I'm sure there is some.
Because you don't want to sue that engineer. You want to sue the railroad.
Well, and again,
they've got a lot more money.
And again, that goes back to what that one English lawyer was saying back in 1916, that this is a deep pocket theory.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it exists.
Right.
So, but I mean, it does kind of make sense. I think there is probably some sort of societal need to find compensation for these people that are injured, you know, to find the deep pocket.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing you can do is, as a company, is pay whatever you end up having to pay and then discipline the employee for failing to follow the proper rules.
Now, I mean, honestly, probably in that scenario you gave when somebody's acting definitely during the scope and course of their employment like that. I mean, the employer probably is going to be liable for it. They can just try to maybe mitigate some of the damages by showing these other things. Maybe, you know, if you don't instruct your engineer to blow the horn like that, and you don't teach him about these different federal safety regulations, that might open you up for punitive damages.
There you go.
But so maybe you can mitigate those punitive damages by showing that you've done these extra training and thing like that.
So. Oh yeah, and all that's documented. So
yeah. So there's some more to talk about, but I think we maybe have a motion pending before the court today.
Why, yes, if it pleases a bench, we'd like to approach to pay for court costs.
And who do we have on the docket today?
We have a brand new sponsor that we're proud to have aboard, and the name of this sponsor is Quip, Q-U-I-P, Quip.
Let me ask you a question.
All right.
What actually makes a better toothbrush? Industrial strength power? Claims of miraculous trendy ingredients? Multiple modes? If you ask your dentist, they'll tell you it's less about the brush and more about how you use it.
That's interesting. And that's also why Quip was created by dentists and product designers to focus on what actually matters for your oral health, healthier habits.
Quip's sensitive vibrations with a built-in timer guide gentle brushing for the dentist recommended 2 minutes and 30 seconds pulses, ensuring an even clean.
Quip automatically delivers brush heads to you every 3 months for clean new bristles right on schedule.
There's nothing worse than a dull toothbrush.
Or dirty bristles.
Dirty bristles. Mm-mm-mm. The sleek, intuitive design is simple to use and comes with a travel cap that doubles as a mirror mount.
These thoughtful features make brushing something you actually want to do twice every day.
I like the mirror mount. I got my Quip toothbrush. First thing I did, mounted it on my mirror.
Well, I keep mine in my drawer.
In the handy-dandy travel case?
Absolutely.
It is really nice, too, the case. Like, that'd be perfect if you were on the go traveling a lot. That makes sure your bristles stay nice and clean and you don't get dirty.
That's right. You know, if it's in your DOP kit, you don't want, you know, your shampoo to leak on it or your deodorant to get on it or something like that. You got to put that thing in your mouth.
If your shampoo and your deodorant's leaking around your DOP kit, I think you got bigger problems than that.
Well, at least it won't transfer to your teeth.
There you go. Good habits matter to live a healthier life, so help form fresh oral health habits with Quip.
And I can say that it has helped me since I started using mine. I'm more likely to brush longer now.
And I'll tell you, as somebody sitting across the table from you, I appreciate that.
Well, you're very welcome. But the gentle vibration from the toothbrush, I never liked the automatic toothbrushes that swirled around because they would throw toothpaste everywhere. Yeah. And sometimes they just hurt because my gums are kind of sensitive. I'm a sensitive guy. But this is just a nice gentle vibration, and your teeth feel super clean afterwards. When I run my tongue around my teeth, it feels smooth to the touch.
Quip starts at just $25, and you'll get your first refill free at getquip.com/court.
This is a simple way to support our show and start brushing better, but you have to go to getquip.com/court to get your first refill free.
Go right now to getquip.com/court.
And brush away with healthier habits.
So now, if you're wanting to determine whether or not the employer is liable, the difference, like we said, between an independent contractor and an employee can be drawn. So independent contractors may not be liable, depending on kind of how you view it. And the way you can view it is there has to be some sort of requisite relationship between the defendant and the tortfeasor.
Remember what? That word came up again. We've never had that before. Now we have it, and we're using it again.
It's no accident. I brought it up again. Do you remember what it means?
Yeah, that's the guy that commits the tort.
Exactly. And you have to examine the relationship between the defendant and the tortfeasor by 3 different tests: the control test, the organization test, and the sufficient relationship test. So an employer may be held liable under the principles of vicarious liability if an employee does an authorized act in an unauthorized way. So kind of similar to what you were talking about.
Right.
Now, there's another Latin phrase that I always like to throw out there, too.
Caveat emptor?
No. That is not it.
Okay.
That is a Latin phrase. Let's see if I've actually never tried to pronounce this phrase before. First time I've ever seen it. So let's see how I do. Qui facit per alium facit per se.
That means the smeller's a feller.
One who acts through another's acts in one's own interests. And so basically, that's a parallel concept to vicarious liability and strict liability, in which a person can be held in criminal law or tort for the acts or omissions of another. So one who acts through another's acts in one's own interests. Hmm. Qui facit per alium facit per se.
Okay.
I just always like throwing out those Latin terms.
Quid pro quo.
Exactly. So what do you got?
Well, what I got, I'm always wondering, how come the guy that does the damage is a tortfeasor, and the guy that gets damaged isn't the tortfeasee?
I guess you could call them that under a strict etymological type designation, but
he's a defendant. That doesn't sound fun.
No one says that.
I know. Why not? He should be the tortfeasee.
You would think so. Now, one interesting thing is that the courts sometimes distinguish when they're looking at these things to determine about whether or not an employee took a detour or a frolic of their own.
A frolic of their own?
Yeah. That's.
You've been found guilty of frolicking while at work.
Well, you see that a lot in the workers' comp compensation scope, too.
Yeah.
So if someone is on a detour or a frolic, workers' comp insurance might not cover them.
But. So, like, they decided to go get a snack or something and then drove off a cliff.
Okay.
And they weren't supposed to be on a break.
Yeah, maybe.
They were just following the GPS. It was out of date.
So an employer actually might be held liable if it's shown the employee just went on like a slight little detour while carrying out their duties. So like if they were on their way to run, to go pick up a box of documents to be scanned,
mm-hmm.
and they go run through McDonald's on their way to there, that's just a mere detour. It's not really out of the ordinary. It's on the way now. But if they decide they want to run over to Cincinnati on their way there to go
play at Kings Island.
Kings Island, and then something happens. You know, we can call Kings Island a frolic.
Yes, I would think we could call it a frolic.
It's a delightful frolic.
Yeah.
So basically, if they're on a frolic, there's probably not going to be liability for the employer. Another cause of action that I've seen sometimes and actually used before is negligent retention of an employee. So basically, if you have an employee that you know has done inappropriate things again and again and again, and you don't discipline them or you don't fire them, and then they do that act again and somebody suffers damages from it, you can actually sue the employer for negligently keeping them as their employee.
I can understand that. Subjecting the general public to their non-feasery.
Yeah. So one really interesting area where this theory has been used quite a bit was under against rental car agencies. So the theory, because we're talking about basically third party liability here, where
right.
there's some act where somebody does something and then somebody else is liable for it. So under this whole respondeat superior doctrine, rental car agencies were held liable for basically any accidents that somebody who rented their car
and they're got responsible into. For the accident.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So. And this is, I mean, it's a little bit of a different theory, but it still spawns from the same kind of area, the same genesis.
Well, I don't agree with that, unless the guy was visibly drunk when you rented him the car, or unless he didn't have a driver's license, or some other. I mean, otherwise, if he presents all the proper documentation, how would you know? That's your business, is to rent people cars.
That's true. Now, you're probably going to be happy with the way the story turns out then.
Well, good. I like happy endings.
Well, I'll start off by telling you a little case here. There was Ethan Ruby.
Old Ethan.
He was a 25-year-old Wall Street trader and a former college athlete. I don't know what that has to do with anything, but he was crossing Delancey Street in Manhattan when the driver of a budget rental vehicle ran a red light. The budget vehicle struck a van, which subsequently plowed into Ruby, hurling him into the windshield of another vehicle 50 feet away and paralyzing him from the chest down. In December 2003, a jury awarded him $24.5 million in damages, holding budget rent-a-car liable under New York's strict vicarious liability law. So that was a jury verdict against budget for that. And a lot of states have these different kind of strict vicarious liability laws against rental car agencies. at the time. Yeah. So it was not uncommon. So if somebody got into an accident in a rental car, it opened up a whole Pandora's box of different liability theories. So this is actually...
That'd be enough to have rethink going in the rental car business.
You would think so, yeah. But in August 2005, Congress passed and President Bush signed into law a comprehensive transportation bill titled Safe, Accountable, Flexible, Efficient Transportation Equity Act.
Is that an acronym?
A legacy for users was SAFE-T and then dash L-U. SAFE-T-L-U.
Safety Lou.
Safety Lou. So one of the things which was included, these acronyms always crack me up. Now, one of the things that was included in it was sponsored by Representative Samuel Graves of Missouri, which is now known as the Graves Amendment.
Yeah.
And basically, this amendment called for preemption and abolition of any state statute or common law precedent that had rental car or leasing agencies vicariously liable for driver's negligence, except when the owner itself was negligent or engaged in criminal wrongdoing. So the federal government actually stepped in and
said, this ain't right.
Said, we're not going to allow this anymore. This was big in Florida, too. Florida courts and federal district courts held the Graves Amendment unconstitutional, stating that Congress had exceeded its authority granted to it by the Commerce Clause, because this is where they're trying to say that the Commerce Clause applies because rental cars touch on interstate commerce.
Sure they do.
And so basically Florida courts were saying, hey, this is, you're overstepping your bounds. This is, you're not constitutional. You can't do it. Well, an appellate court actually weighed in on the issue in the 11th Circuit and said that, no, the Graves Amendment was constitutional, and basically said that in Florida that the statutory and common law was preempted and said, no, the Florida law doesn't matter anymore. The Graves Amendment controls. You cannot have any kind of vicarious liability against rental car companies.
Well, like I say, there should be certain things that they would be responsible for, like making sure they are a properly licensed driver and making sure they're not like drunk at the time that they rent the car or something like that. But beyond that, you know, you're just running a business, you know, and it'd be like selling somebody a car and then going back and holding the car manufacturer responsible or the car dealership responsible because the guy went out and ran over somebody.
The interesting thing about this, especially in Florida, which I'm more familiar with, that basically this had been on the books for 90 years in Florida. Like this has been a common cause
for rental cars.
For rental cars, it's not something new that came up. This was a well-established doctrine. So to take this away was kind of a big deal, because essentially this whole legal theory had been going on for almost 100 years. I mean, it was quite some time. So for them to come in and change this was kind of revolutionary if you think about it.
And what'd you say it was, 2005?
2005, yeah.
Wow, that wasn't that long ago.
No.
In the overall scheme of things, for some of us older fellers.
Well, and getting to the point now with me and my legal career, I remember when I first came out of law school that there still was vicarious liability for rental car agencies.
I bet you they had to have massive insurance policies to protect themselves because of that.
Yeah. Well, this one article I was reading was talking about how this came about because of a lot of lobbyist interests, and that lobbyists were really pushing for this to want to change this law. And so I decided I would do a little digging into it and checked Representative Graves' campaign contributions on a website called opensecrets.org.
Oh.
And so this sponsored amendment was passed in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not counting PACs because I don't know what the PACs stand for. I didn't go that deep.
All right.
But this is just the money that you can actually see. Enterprise Rent-A-Car gave him $20,000 in 2003 and 2004.
Mm-hmm.
$48,200 in 2005-2006,
mm-hmm.
$138,500 in 2007-2008 for a job well done. I'm just saying that. 2009-2010, they didn't give him anything. 2011-2012, they must have needed something else, so they gave him $26,500. 2013-2014, they gave him $10,500. 2015-2016, they gave him $11,000. Hmm. So, I mean, basically that amendment was bought and paid for by rental car companies.
Wait, was that all just Enterprise?
That was just Enterprise.
Well, surely there were other ones too.
I imagine there probably were. Like I said, maybe they were in PACs or from different contributions. Those are just the open ones that I could actually see. Just, you know, doing some. I didn't spend a lot of time researching this, but doing a little bit. So obviously, you know, Senator or Congressman Graves was very passionate about this, and it was one of the linchpins of his thing. He needed to change this around.
Yeah. Avis was probably number two, but they try harder.
Well, the only problem I have with this is that if somebody is hurt in an accident involving a rental car, then it could, in theory, if that person doesn't have adequate insurance, it could leave somebody without any kind of recourse for someone else's negligence. Do you understand what I'm saying?
But I may be wrong about this, but you either have to sign something for the insurance on it, or you have to have it covered by your own insurance.
That's true.
I mean, to rent a car, right? You can't just say, I don't have any insurance and I don't want yours.
Well, I don't think you can do that either. I just rented a car not too long ago, and they said, do you want our insurance? And I said, no. I said, I'll just use mine. She's like, well, we need to see a copy of the policy.
Exactly.
And she was like, same on it. So I pulled up my app and I said, here it is. Stick that in your pipe and smoke it. Truculent woman.
Truculent. You didn't call her succulent, did you?
No, I definitely didn't.
Truculent.
Truculent.
There's a big difference.
So that's the only thing I can see, you know, but for them renting this car to this person, this innocent person wouldn't have been in this accident.
Yeah.
If you think about it, because they don't rent the car doesn't swerve off the road and strike somebody, doesn't hurt them.
I think the reason they threw that in about being a college athlete is that somehow they feel like that makes it that much more terrible that the guy was paralyzed.
Yeah.
As if it wouldn't bad enough if you were just a guy that sat on the couch and you end up paralyzed. But he's a college athlete, so that somehow makes it worse.
Yeah, he's vivacious, you know.
He's vivacious?
Yeah.
And succulent?
And succulent.
Well, I wouldn't have referred to him as vivacious.
Well, I've never seen
him. I have a completely different definition of vivacious.
I've never seen his picture before.
Well, okay.
He could be vivacious. I don't know.
Maybe.
I'm just throwing it out there and seeing what sticks.
All right. I don't think that made it.
Well,
I fell off the wall.
Talking about the person I'm beating on here, Congressman Graves, lately he appears to be taking a lot of money from railroads. So look for him to sponsor some sort of railroad-related legislation here in the upcoming months.
That's why they got to take the money out of politics. This is terrible. These people are not acting on their constituents' behalf. They're acting on who's going to come up with the money. They're just like that movie that Tom Cruise was in with Cuba Gooding Jr. Show me the money.
I just for whatever reason, I decided I would look and see who basically gave this guy money about the same time that was sponsored. And, you know, sure enough, it was patently obvious. He took the money, he sponsored this.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So, that's why, you know, you say, how come all of our representatives are millionaires?
Yeah.
This is why. Now, supposedly that doesn't go to them, it goes to campaign contributions, but somehow they end up being millionaires. I don't know how it works, but it's all intertwined there somehow.
Yeah. Anyway, that's kind of one interesting kind of little spinoff on vicarious liability for somebody else. I thought it was kind of interesting.
All right. Now, here's the part of that whole doctrine that I'm interested in, and that's where parents are responsible for kids.
Well, I mean, they should be. They're their spawn.
They're their spawn. It sounds evil. They're their spawn from hell. And they must pay. Turn loose their spawn on their putrid spawn. I had that line as Captain Hook.
Oh, yeah.
Back, you putrid spawn.
I actually saw you as Captain Hook.
Well, I thought that was pretty intense line there for Peter Pan.
You putrid spawn.
Yeah.
where did you pull that hook from? You just carry that around with you all the time?
Yeah. Yeah. I had to my neighbor across the street make it for me.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. He welded it for me.
You actually don't have your hook.
I do have it.
No, I mean on you right now.
No, not right on me. I can go upstairs in my closet and dig it out.
How many hooks do you have? Do you have like separate hooks for different occasions?
Oh, no. I only have the one. It's festively adorned with gold and gold glitter.
Garishly?
No, not garish. Ghoulish.
Ghoulish. Vivaciously.
Yeah, it's vivacious. But there's several different theories on that, on the parents being responsible for the children's action. it says parental liability is a term used to refer to a parent's obligation to pay for damage caused by negligent, intentional, or criminal acts committed by the parent's child. A parent's liability usually ends when the child reaches the age of majority and doesn't begin until the child reaches 8 to 10 years old. Today, most states have laws relating to parental liability in various applications. So if they're under 8 or 10 years old, they're going to say, hey, they didn't know any better.
Yeah.
Too bad. But the parents don't have any responsibility. After you're over somewhere from 8 to 10, then the parents, but depending on state law, it breaks down by different states, but you may be liable. Now, a lot of states have put caps on it.
So like old enough to know better, but still too young to care?
Yeah.
That's a country music song, I believe.
Well, it's, you just need to have a dog in there somewhere.
Truck, lifted truck, jeans, drinking beer.
Whoop, whoop. Yeah, your woman leaving you.
Yep.
In most states, parents are responsible for all malicious or willful property damage done by their children. This is called civil parental liability because it's non-criminal. The parent is obligated only to financially compensate the party harmed by his or her child's actions. But laws vary by state to state regarding monetary limits on damages that can be collected and the age limits of children. California law, for example, imposes a $25,000 limit per incident on parents or guardians for damages resulting from a minor's willful misconduct. Now,
that seems reasonable.
I read about another one, though, that was in Georgia. And in this one, two 15-year-old boys broke into a house causing property damage. Under Georgia tort law, a victim could sue the parent of a child who committed a willful act against the victim, such as vandalism, for an award of up to $500.
Whew.
That's it. The homeowner sued the boy's parents under the law and won $500 from each of the boy's parents.
Well, that sounds fair and square.
The parents appealed, arguing that they were denied the due process because the statute penalized them for acts of others. The Georgia Supreme Court rejected the parents' argument, finding that Georgia had a legitimate interest in preventing vandalism and that the statute was designed to serve that interest because the cap damages would encourage parental supervision. It upheld the judgment against the parents.
Well, I gotta think. I mean, that seems pretty reasonable to me. I think $25,000 seems like a reasonable cap to me.
Well, it does, but I mean, $500. Those guys are—they ought to figure they got off cheap.
I would think so. I mean, you can't get your drywall fixed for $500.
No, and I'm sure it was probably more than that. If I was the people that got vandalized,
yeah.
I'd be going to the court saying, hey, I know it says $500, but they need to pay for this,
yeah,
whatever the cost was. Maybe I don't come out better off, but they at least need to pay for the cost to cover it.
Yeah, it doesn't seem very equitable.
No, it doesn't. Now, if it was $25,000 from each parent, okay, you could probably repair the damage for that.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
So,
and maybe have a nice little addition in your bathroom.
That's right.
Maybe get that bidet you've always been eyeing.
Yeah. Well, it's not the eye that it's for, though. Not that eye, anyway. Now, Philadelphia had a particular problem with kids, and they had to outline their own set of laws for it. They had mobs of teenagers that sometimes meeting without a goal in mind ended up being involved in various illegal activities such as assaulting people at random or stealing from stores in Philadelphia's tourist and shopping district.
Or running up the stairs with Rocky.
Well, they moved Rocky.
Did they?
Yeah, Rocky went somewhere else now. I don't think he's up there anymore.
Oh.
I just saw somebody posted something and they went running up the stairs and Rocky wasn't there. They were in Philadelphia. They went running up the stairs and Rocky wasn't there. I don't know. I'm not sure. I think they moved him to a museum or something. I don't know. Anyway, he's not there. I don't think.
I didn't know.
I could be wrong, but I don't think he is. The mayor, Michael A. Nutter, spoke out sharply against these youths and their behaviors. The Utes.
Mm-hmm.
My cousin Vinny.
Yeah.
The Utes. Who? The Utes. He also took aim at the teenager's parents, saying that being a human ATM or a sperm donor will not suffice for being a parent, and that parents need to get a hold of their kids before we have to.
Get a hold of your spawn.
That's right. Nutter emphasized that he believes that problems like these flash mobs are stemming from the homes and parents, and they need to take more responsibility for the children. Nutter certainly has the law on his side in Philadelphia, as they, like many other cities, can impose penalties on the parents when the children are out past city curfew. In Philadelphia, the parents receive a warning for the first violation, up to a $150 fine for a second violation, and $300 to $500 fines for subsequent violations. After two or more violations, each repeat offense can result in up to a $300 fine and or up to 90 days in jail for the parent.
Stick them in jail for not watching their kid. That'll help somebody watch their kid.
Well, they'll have to hire a sitter. But
it's one of those kind of counterintuitive type.
Well, that's true, but what do you do? You know, if these kids are out running wild and the parents aren't taking any action for it, you know, the teachers, I read a thing that was written up by a school teacher saying, look, we're not the ones that are raising your kids. You're supposed to be raising. When they come to school, they come here to learn. They don't come here to learn how to be a human being. They're supposed to be learning subject matters and becoming more intelligent.
Right.
But a lot of you parents just think you send them to school and that's the end of your responsibility.
Yeah.
And they're saying this is not the place where people learn how to be a decent human being, you know. But they feel like that they're faced with that. It says, if my child injured someone, can I be liable? And it says, vicariously for your children's actions. Here are some situations when parents may be vicariously liable for their minor children's conduct.
Easy for you to say.
Agency theory.
Yep.
If a child commits a wrongful act while following directions from his parent, then the parent may be vicariously liable.
Agency theory.
Now, we've seen stories in there where parents have their kids, they'll go and divert the shopkeeper's attention and have their kid shoplifting or something like that. They figure, well, if the kid gets caught shoplifting, they're not going to do anything to them.
Right.
That's where the parents need to be charged, you know, because they're acting on behalf of the parents.
Sure.
Parents have taught them what to do.
Probably need to take those kids out of that home, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Break that cycle.
That's right. Unicycle.
Those kids are going to grow up. You know what they're going to do?
They're going to do the same thing.
Yep.
The family car doctrine. A parent who owns a vehicle will be vicariously liable for his child's wrongful conduct when the child drives under the parent's express or implied consent.
Yep.
Permissive use doctrine. In some states, an automobile owner is vicariously liable for anyone's tortuous conduct when the car is driven with the owner's consent.
Unless you're a rental car company.
Well, yeah. Under this theory, an owner parent may be liable for his minor child's wrongful driving. So it's not like you have to know that he was a negligent driver or anything. You're just automatically responsible for it if you turn him loose.
Yeah.
And it says, are there limits on these laws? Most states place limits on the amount of money a parent would have to pay. Iowa limits theirs to $2,000 per act. So there you are, all over the board. 25,000 in California, 2,000 in Iowa, and 500 in Georgia.
Yeah.
I guess they figure in Georgia they don't have anything there worth more than about $500.
That's a whole bushel of peaches, son.
Daddy, they done drove through the shack. Well, wait for some more wood to wash up on the shore and we'll patch her up.
I think it's basically one of those things that they just, these lawmakers, when they make these laws, they just have a dartboard and they just throw a dart. they don't put any thought into it. They're just like, 25,000 seems good.
Yeah, that's what I mean. These limits, every state coming up with these different amounts on it. I don't know. I mean, somehow, why wouldn't you just go with the theory the person should be made whole?
Right.
Isn't that what most law is based on? That somebody has a tort against them, you're making them whole? That's what the lawsuit is for?
Well, yeah, but you got to think, courts actually used to be designated between courts of law and courts of equity, whereas courts of law were from some sort of legal ruling, whereas courts of equity were to basically make you whole. But they don't have those designations anymore. They've all merged into one thing. So,
yeah,
you know, our wise lawmakers have deemed it appropriate to put limits and caps on things. So,
well, and speaking of merging into one thing, there are certain laws that if you break, your child breaks, is automatically criminal negligence on your part.
Right.
Now, whoever, if there was like a third party that was damaged as a result of that, they can use that criminal charge against you that you've been found guilty of as per se negligence in a civil case.
Right.
So you can turn around in your civil case and you don't even have to prove anything. All you have to do is cite that finding that they were criminally negligent and you win your case.
Yeah. You essentially, I guess, move for summary judgment on that based upon the, there's no factual scenario which you would lose.
Right. It's negligence per se.
Exactly. One situation like that might be like if your child got into your, like your handgun or something like that and you didn't have it locked in a safe and then they went out and did some sort of horrible crime with that handgun that you let them have by your own negligence, then that could very easily be some sort of parental liability.
Well, and it doesn't even have to be a horrible crime. I mean, what you read about all the time is the one kid finding the gun and accidentally shooting their friend or their sibling or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, with that gun. And they say, well, you shouldn't hold the parents responsible. I mean, here they're suffering. They lost a child because of that. Yeah. But they didn't lock the gun up or have it where they couldn't be found or whatever. They brought the gun into the situation, which is why this horrible accident happened.
Yeah, exactly.
Somebody is responsible for it.
Somebody's got to pay.
Yeah. I mean, as terrible as that would be, you lose a child if a sibling, say, found a gun and shot the other sibling. You lose a child, but why didn't you have that gun properly secured?
Yeah.
That's just one of those other things for me about why we don't need more guns around. Because you read about that all the time. Somebody getting shot accidentally when a kid finds a gun.
Yeah.
And I didn't know it was loaded.
Well, I think that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is a part of the show where we talk about different legal terms. We got a lot of them to choose from this one.
Sure. Grind them up and see what falls out.
Well, if I'm going to have to pick one to grind up first, I'm going with a good old-fashioned Latin term.
Caveat emptor.
All right, let's see if I can pronounce it one more time. Once more into the breach. Qui facit per alium facit per se.
That's that one that says if you're acting on actions of someone else's actions and it benefits you, then you're in trouble.
Let me just read what it actually means.
Something to that effect.
Well, you kind of actually, you were going, I was like, No. One who acts through another's acts in one's own interests.
Yeah. So, for your own good or something. Yeah. That's what I said instead of your own interest.
Yeah.
Well, you know, something like that. You were benefiting from doing something that someone else told you to do and it was wrong.
Yeah, there we go. What is respondeat superior?
That's the person that tells somebody else what to do. They're the person in control, like they're the employer. In the old days, they were the master and the servant. I mean, they were the master that told the servant what to do.
Well, yeah, but the whole, it's a, basically an overarching theory. Oh. So it's the overarching theory that someone else is going to be liable for controlling or having someone else do something.
Right.
So basically it's a way to establish some sort of third party liability against somebody.
Okay.
What is vicarious liability?
That means that when somebody else does something, like your child does something that's criminal or negligent or something like that, you as a parent may be liable for it.
That's right. And what is strict liability?
Strict liability means you don't really have to prove anything. Just if it happens and you're responsible, then you get it.
Yep. And that's what vicarious liability is. Vicarious liability is kind of a form of strict liability.
That's what they had with the rental cars.
Yep.
If you rented them a car and they wrecked it and hurt somebody, then the rental car agency was responsible.
And what was the name of the amendment to change that?
The Graves Amendment.
That's right.
Because they sent them all to their grave.
And who do we have to thank for that, Mr.
Senator Graves.
Senator Graves. Bought and paid for by
Enterprise Rent-A-Car. Aren't they they're the ones that have that, what's his name, War Borton? Joe from Family Guy, and he was also Putty on Seinfeld.
Yeah.
That guy, Patrick Warburton, isn't it? Yeah.
He's got a very dry delivery.
Yeah, he does.
Well, you actually did really good on this legal briefs section.
Well, I was listening today.
Yeah.
I was fully awake.
I'm going to take vicarious responsibility for you for knowing so much.
That's good. I need somebody to take responsibility for me because there's no telling what I might do.
It's a limited vicarious responsibility.
Oh, no. You bought the whole boat, feller. Everybody knows I'm not responsible for my actions, so you just stepped up. I thank you.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, and welcome to Tommy's Random Thoughts. Today's random thought is cow farts. Yes, cow farts. I know, I said it. Sorry about that, but they tell me that the methane that arises from cow farts, and I do mean arises, is the number one destroyer of the ozone. This worries me. What do we do about that? We like to eat cows. There's a lot of cows, but yet their methane is destroying the ozone. California actually tried to pass a bill that would make farmers do something about cow emissions. I don't know if you'd have to take them into a shop and have them checked like the cars are for emissions, but this sounds very troublesome. I mean, they could make an individualized device, like some kind of a cow butt muffler or something, I guess, that you'd have to insert in a poor cow's butt, and he'd have to carry this contraption around, and somewhere it'd have to have some kind of filter or deactivator or something. But I'm not sure. It might even be a motorized type filter, and all these cows would be walking around with motorized butts, and I just don't see that happening. Then the other thing you could do, I guess, is you'd have to dome in all the cow pastures to trap all that methane within that dome. I would hate to walk in that dome. But then still again, you have the problem of you've got to neutralize that methane before it goes out into the universe. It makes our hole bigger, our ozone hole. We have to address the ozone hole. So anyway, I don't know that that's going to work. So what do we do about cow farts? We could quit eating cows and all the cows would go away, although that seems pretty inhumane to extinct the cows because they fart too much. I know some people that might fall in that category and would need one of those butt plugging devices, but that's neither here nor there. But I'm still not sure what we do about this problem. If we quit eating cows and start eating the things that cows eat, then we'll be letting out the emissions. Then what do? I don't want to walk around with a motorized butt plug on me. And I don't want to live in a dome filled with farts. Someone's got to come up with an answer to cow farts. This has been Tommy's Random Thought.